It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello, this is the Redbox Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley, bringing you the best of my Times radio show. We're coming to you live from the Conservative Party conference from 10 till 1. You can hear there's quite a lot of lurgy, actually, here in Manchester. I've got a sore throat. There's just a lot of conference cold going on. Right, coming up on today's episode of the podcast, Michael Gove, the levelling up secretary, on whether or not this Conservative Party is now just some 80s tribute act. We take a look at 100 years of Tory turmoil. There's a new book out on the 1922 Committee, which is the sort of backbench group of Tory MPs who cause endless trouble and have a habit, more recently, of removing prime ministers. So we'll take a look at that in just a moment. But before that, it's today's columnist panel.
The Columnists on Times Radio.
And it's Tuesday, so of course we are joined by Danny Finkelstein. Hello, Danny.
Hello. I think that leaderboard thing, that did you get the person who did Theresa May's signage?
Yeah, the Times Radio the buzzer game leaderboard, where we're supposed to... Oh, they're just falling off. I know, it's terrible. I've got a sore throat. The thing, somebody's going to give me the P45 in a minute. That'll complete the full set. So Danny's here. Also, Miranda Green. Miranda, nice to see you.
Hello.
Miranda from the FT. Nice to see you. Nice to have you both together, because you had quite the ding-dong last week after Danny dared to suggest there was no point to the Lib Dems. And now I can't help thinking we're sitting here this week, Miranda, asking, what's the point of the Tory party?
Well, you know, they remain the government for now, of course. And as the great Rob Ford, the political scientist of Manchester University, our local expert here, as we're all in Manchester, was saying to me last week in Bournemouth, actually, I think people have forgotten how volatile the electorate are these days. So even though it looks obvious what might happen at the general election next year, we should bear in mind that there are strange reversals of fortune and the electorate could suddenly shift in another direction. So I agree with you, there is a slight sort of fin de siècle feeling here at Manchester, but you never know, right? You never know. And there are ways in which Rishi Sunak could find a way back.
Yeah, look, I'm pretty convinced that they're not going to get a majority at the next general election, but despite, you know, it's also the convention of a governing party, so it's interesting to see what its spirit is, but also where it's heading. I think there are signs that would encourage someone like me, but there are also certainly signs that wouldn't.
My slight sense from a lot of the announcements, we're going to talk to Michael Gove about this later, they're all a bit sort of small or re-announcements or a bit retro. In fact, this was the Environment Secretary Therese Coffey with her big announcement yesterday.
Beginning further to help farmers and rural businesses by making the most of our Brexit freedoms. Freedom from European rules. Freedom to choose what works best for Britain. And we've already legislated to allow gene editing so that we can design crops that are fit for the future. And my officials are cutting red tape and introducing smarter regulation. You know, frankly, bent or straight, it's not the government to decide the shape of bananas you want to eat. I just need to assure you that they are safe to eat. So we will be dropping absurd regulations, including the one on bendy bananas.
Frankly, bent or straight, it's not for the government to decide the shape of bananas you want to eat. It's the 1980s, Danny. A cabinet minister using their big conference speech to make an announcement on bendy bananas.
OK, so funnily enough, everyone always thinks the agriculture speech is ridiculous because there's something comical about people talking about items of food from the platform.
Yeah.
Obviously, and often, by the way,
but also the audience that feels similar. That is Liz Truss's fault because of the famous
cheesegate. Yeah.
Absolutely, but I think there is anyway, and often
and pork products. We shouldn't let's have a moment.
Market.
Yeah,
so it
market.
Is an attempt to kind of inject into, and we see that a lot of conference speeches actually, an attempt to inject a sort of John F. Kennedy or Martin Luther King on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial into a speech about commuter trains, and it just the dissonance can often be quite comical. However, obviously, quite a lot of these things do mean more probably than the big pieces of rhetoric, so they're worthwhile listening to carefully.
But to your earlier point, though, Matt, about kind of is this a government sort of that's slightly given up?
Yeah.
It's a bit sort of work to rule conference speeches. It felt to me. Interestingly, on the fringes, I've been doing some kind of policy fringes, and all of the conversations end up in the same place, which unfortunately is we better try and get cross-party agreement on this so that it can happen. So that doesn't actually show a great expectation of this party that's gathered here today being able to take on the ideas that really matter.
So they're saying sort of like going start the conversation on pensions or on climate change.
Yeah, or education reform, which is what I've been talking about for a couple of days. And so it always ends up in this place. So it feels as if the expectation is we're all here talking to the current party of government, but see you next week in Liverpool where we really need to do a deal.
That's obviously partly because there are a lot of people who are not part of any political party at a party conference.
Yeah.
But also, I was actually reassured by that element of it because it is at least realistic. I have attended Conservative Party conferences where to the external observer, it's completely obvious what the political position is, but nobody else gets it. And you seem like you're living on another planet. And I find a degree of realism that nobody's saying, I think the Conservative Party stands no chance whatsoever of winning, but, and they're probably more optimistic than the situation warrants even now, but it's not completely out to lunch. And I have experienced periods, even when I was, in like 2000, for example, when it was obvious the Conservative Party was going to lose, but the party chairman was absolutely convinced we were going to win the election, which was obviously unrealistic. So I think it's probably good that they're a little bit more grounded in the reality of what's going to happen. But I'm somewhat more worried about the sort of leakage of cranky ideas. For example, like the 15-minute city is a conspiracy to make people live in their houses and not be able to get out. Those kind of cranky online ideas seeping into mainstream debate. That's a little bit worrying. The Nigel Farage and Priti Patel thing, you get people from other parties coming to conferences, but the idea of accepting Nigel Farage as a member, effectively like a member of the, treated like a member of the Conservative Party through GB News, that is a worrying development. So there are the ability to make, funnily enough, the things about bananas, weird though that is, and the fact that speeches are workmanlike attempts to address apprenticeships and bananas and things that actually happen and really affect, or HS2, right? These are actually worthwhile things that are real things and not fantasy things. I'm less worried about that than I am about kind of bits of unrealistic politics, sometimes slightly sinister, entering into mainstream
debate. But what's interesting about that, that tells us that actually the Tories are struggling to work out how to attack the Labour Party, because whether it's the 50-minute cities, the meat tax, we had Claire Coutinho, the energy secretary claiming that Labour were relaxed about a meat tax, that's just not true. They're sort of having to make up things.
That isn't true.
And then knock them down.
They're not. Sorry, Amanda.
No,
your turn. It's not true about the meat tax. What Minette Batter says isn't quite correct, which is there has actually been a debate about meat tax. It's not an invented issue. It's just that
Labour's against it. Yeah. Well, that's what I mean. But it's interesting that in trying to attack the Labour Party, they're having to sort of make up Labour policies and then knock them down again.
Well, it's sort of, I wondered whether with the meat tax particularly there was a bit of a kind of Lyndon Johnson stuff going on. He famously said, you throw some outrageous slur against your opponent because you make the bastard deny it.
Yeah.
And then they've said it through their own words.
Yeah.
The association in the public mind is with that idea, however untrue it was. But it is slightly desperate. However, on matters to do with the economy, it's very, very useful for the Tory party to make the Labour bastards deny it. So actually, I think there's an exception to this, which is, you know, for example, Jeremy Hunt's speech yesterday, although it was slightly short and a bit lacklustre again, 20 minutes for the Chancellor seems crazy to me. He could have gone on much longer and told us some more. But, you know, if they hammer Labour with the idea that they are still the party of tax and spend, and then Labour is increasingly always in a slightly panicky way having to insist that they're not, that probably is quite useful for them. Yeah, yeah. But on meat, etc., so no, it's great, it sounds mad.
Let's leave meat to one side because the Labour Party has said, Ed Miliband said directly that he didn't agree with that idea. But let's take the idea of tax and spend because it's a little more complicated. Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer are suggesting that they're not, you know, a party of tax and spend. To what extent do you, Miranda, or me, really believe that that is actually their position? I cannot see how Labour can achieve the broad aspirations of the centre-left, right? You know, moderate mainstream aspirations, but their broad aspirations without increasing spending and tax. So, therefore, I don't think that advancing the idea, despite the fact that Keir Starmer is unspecific and, you know, to some extent they're denying that, advancing the idea that that is what the consequence of a Labour government does. It's a difficult one, that, because you are therefore defying the fact they're saying, you know, we're against it, and you're saying, and the Conservative Party is responding, they're in favour of it. But despite that, it is actually my strong instinct that if you got a Labour government, that is precisely what it would do. So it's a legitimate part of the argument. So it's a slightly more complicated
but
one
also,
than it seems.
I wonder where were the public on this? Because public services, there's a YouGov poll out today on public services, and across the board, everyone says they're in a bad state. I mean, the best that they've get to is about 25% say fire services in a bad state, but like 86% say the NHS, hospitals, GPs, social care, trains, police. So, and people think that, you know, rich people should be paying more tax. You know, Rishi Sunak, these rich mates, that actually the idea of more taxes to make our public services less rubbish is not a terrible position.
Not Labour's position.
No, right? It's not.
So this is a critical point. It's not Labour's position, despite the fact that they obviously want the votes of a population whose position it is.
Yes.
And I can't see how they square that except by probably moving towards where the population is. And then it becomes a legitimate part of the argument. Is that actually a good idea when taxes are so incredibly high? I don't...
That is true. I do agree with everything that Danny has said, and I think it's the right attack for the Tories to make on Labour for that reason. However, I think there's a fundamental problem with Jeremy Hunt saying, as he did in his speech, it's the historic mission of the Tory party to drive down your taxes and to drive down the tax burden, since, as the IFS said a few days ago, this turns out to be the biggest tax raising Parliament pretty much in history or since records began. And so you're again having this problem that the current set of Tory ministers have to defend a record that is not a good record to back up their argument for voting them in again, right? So both parties are actually on slightly shaky ground on tax and spend, I think. But yeah, I think Matt's point is the right one. If the public realm looks like a mess, fundamentally, who are the party that traditionally are trusted by the electorate to repair it? And that is not the Conservative Party, and that's the kind of fundamental, I think.
Because Labour will historically drive up spending. So my view about it is that the Tory party... I used to drive my son to school when he was a baby. He would... or to nursery, and he would say, go faster, Daddy. Yeah. And I would say, I'll go as fast as possible, consistent with safety. Okay, it was a joke of teaching him how to speak language. And then after that, he would always go from the back of the car, go as fast as possible, consistent with safety, Daddy. But the point is, what the Conservative Party is trying to do, obviously, is keep taxes as low as possible, consistent with its obligations.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's not, in fact, inconsistent to have been the party that during this period of COVID and during this period, actually, by the way, of Brexit, but during this period of, recently the oil price rises, for the Conservative Party to have seen a big rise in taxation, yeah, while still saying we are relatively the party that favours control of taxation, yeah, over spending. And it is where the argument really is. And the problem for the Conservative Party is, what do you do in a situation in which Labour... just denies it's going to do that when we all think it probably will. So that is why they then get themselves into the mistake of inventing other policies, yeah, that are plausibly, like, let's face it, it's totally plausible that as part of an obesity and You know, Downing Street under Tony Blair proposed a fat tax,
yeah.
right? It's totally plausible. It just happens not to be their policy. So I how that happens. The 15-minute city thing is a whole different thing, because that is a wholly invented, slightly bonkers conspiracy theory linked to a number of other conspiracy theories about, say, vaccines, which is really legitimate politicians should not dabble with. So I think these are different graded things.
It's a weird thing where we could go into an election where, with a Tory party claiming they're going to do tax cuts when they're not really, and the Labour Party claiming they're not going to put up taxes, but they will. They're, both sides are sort of being disingenuous.
But, yeah, but the voters are very sophisticated about that, right? So neither of them will get away with it. But your point about all the policies that are being thrown out here in Manchester, all a bit nuts and also a bit low level, is actually really interesting, because the fact is the whole conference has spent the last 2 weeks, well, actually, the whole conference season has been dominated by the HS2 lack of decision. And that is partly because it seems to me no one at the higher levels of government has thought, what other shiny thing can we throw out for the magpies to look at? There is nothing else to talk about.
If they'd announced it wasn't coming to Manchester, it wouldn't have been every question. Yeah, Rishi Sunak did a media round this morning. It wouldn't have been every question.
Yeah, but sorry,
they failed essentially to give us anything else to talk about, which is a real mistake.
Yeah,
but one of the things that people are making a mistake on with HS2 is that the assumption is it's a kind of gaffe that we're talking about HS2. The government didn't need to talk about HS2. They've deliberately raised it because they think it's the right thing to do. Right.
Yeah.
So the one thing with HS2 which we should just remember is they've obviously calculated or decided, whether they've calculated or not, that this is something they want to talk about, because otherwise they don't need to talk about
it. They could have just left it as it was,
right? So they've made a decision which is all part, they've actually made the conference slogan long-term decisions for a brighter future. So
they keep going on about hard decisions.
So it's not a gaffe, this thing that the conference is dominated by this big decision.
It doesn't mean it's not a mistake, though.
No, that's a different question.
You know, for Andy Street, the Conservative mayor of Birmingham and the West Midlands, to say this is effectively cancelling the future for my region is not great.
Yeah. It's a big dispute between.
But it's an interesting
people.
Point you make that Rishi Sunak thinks this is the good, right thing to do.
Yes, I mean, look, there are different people.
The fact is people doubt it.
Well, that's late
Ed
period. That's late period Blair, isn't it? You know, through gritted teeth, this is the right thing for the country to do.
Ed Balls and Peter Mandelson, for example, opposed to HS2. Whereas
where were they?
You know, George Osborne. Yeah, but I'm just saying that it splits people of all different politics. Is what
I mean. Up next, we're going to go for a slightly lighter conversation. We're going to talk about Nazi memorabilia.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Good morning to you. It's Matt Jolly coming to you live from the Conservative Party conference in an almost sunny Manchester this morning. I've now got a cup of hot honey. Honey water, which is transformative. I sound loads better already. Thank you, producer. I'm still joined by Danny Finkelstein and Amanda Green. Both of you doing the fringe meeting circuit, Danny.
Yeah, there's so many fringe meetings about subjects you probably never even knew. Well, I've learnt that certain things are political issues which I never even knew were. Today I'm doing one which is, I think, definitely falls into that category. I'm doing one on the sale of Nazi memorabilia. As listeners will possibly recall from previous panels, I'm very interested in the whole question of collection of Nazi material. That's what my grandfather did, and how he fought the Nazis was through that. So the sale of that material is obviously of great interest to me. And the Board of Deputies has organised a fringe meeting to draw attention to this and to discuss how best to regulate its the sale of these items, which, you know, in the context of a general concern which we were discussing earlier about the spread of far right conspiracies and the idea that Nazi memorabilia will be a fashion item is concerning. So it's a worthwhile thing to do, even if minor key. But there are lots of minor key things going around the conference hall.
What about you, Miranda? You've been fringing.
I have been fringing. I love a good conference fringe. It's brilliant. You know, because they gather. Quite often they're organised by think tanks or, as Danny says, other organisations. And they gather everyone who's passionately engaged with that particular topic in one room. You know, and as a journalist, apart from anything else, it would take you 3 days probably to track down all those people and interview them about whatever the topic
point.
Is.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I've got a full notebook. you know, of great quotes, ideas, which I just have to write up now, and my sort of policy area is education. There were lots of people yesterday discussing the Sunak plan to get people to study maths to 18, which is a really hot topic in education circles. You know, can this be made to work? Another one of these things where everyone's anticipating trying to formulate a plan they can then sell to the Labour Party to carry through.
Yeah.
It's been absolutely fascinating. I love it. It's really where the action is sometimes at a party conference. It's a shame that the public don't get that broadcast to them so much, actually.
Yeah, it's true. And whenever I've chaired a fringe or the portal,
really lively.
You always come around just thinking, I didn't know that. Interesting.
People turn up, not quite to heckle, although I did get heckled at a Lib Dem conference fringe once.
Wow.
It wasn't Danny.
Although I was embodying your spirit of scepticism about the Lib Dem position on Brexit at the time, which is probably why the audience
throw a berry at you.
Wasn't quite that bad. There was hissing though, and in sharp intakes of breath.
Have you both seen the video of Priti Patel and Nigel Farage singing "Can't Take My Eyes Off of You"?
No. And how much do I have to pay you to not show it to me?
Yes, I did recently see Ed Balls and George Osborne dancing to "Things Can Only Get Better."
Wow.
Wow, that's pretty bad.
What's the worst thing you've ever seen, Miranda?
Well, the worst political thing I've ever seen, or the most memorable strange sight, certainly, is when I, years ago, was in the beautiful wood-panelled room of the late, great Robin Cook when he was Foreign Secretary. And he had a funny little cupboard off to the side that was full of all the strange gifts that he'd been given by foreign dignitaries coming to London. And he decided to try some of them on for us. And so he gave us this really strange little kind of dressing up box moment of putting on the robes and fabulous a green silk turban from, I think, somewhere in the Stans. It was really quite extraordinary.
Yeah, well, I'd take that over Priti Patel and Nigel Farage.
Anytime.
Now, while I've both got you here, do one of you want to have a go at the hand buzzer game? So these are the rules. Three people have done it so far. Victoria Atkins, the Treasury Minister, is the best. So, there we are. Are we hearing that? Can we hear that? Yeah, very good. Okay. So Danny's going to go first. It's against... No, you haven't started. You're not allowed to start yet. Go back to the beginning. Stop cheating. You get 5 seconds added for every buzz. And while you're doing it, you have to recite Rishi Sunak's 5 pledges.
Okay, so...
On your marks.
Every instant of a...
Every time you touch it.
Right. Okay.
Right. Ready, steady, go. That's just cheating. You're just buzzing it all the time. No, I think this is... You're not playing by the rules.
You said every instant. Right? I believe in rules-based conservatism.
Well, you've not abided by the rules.
That was the rules.
You said
every instant.
So
it was one instance of touching. You never said how long the duration.
Your approach to games is the same as Liz Truss's approach to the economy. And now we're going to have you removed. Miranda Green from the FT, and of course Danny Finkelstein from the Times. And you can read Danny in the Times every week. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next is Michael Gove.
Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Now, joining me on the stage, hot footing from the... You've just been on the stage, and now you've joined Times Radio. Michael
Cohen. Oh, Times Radio, always first.
Except not in this case, because you have to...
With the news.
What have you just been wowing the crowds with in your speech?
I've been explaining to the audience the significant achievements of the last 13 years of Conservative government, and then outlining some of our plans for housing and meeting our housing targets in the future, and also saying a little bit about levelling up.
Well, you're in charge of levelling up. Is completing the leg of HS2 to Euston in central London, but scrapping the line to Manchester, going to help level up the north?
Well, you are, like so many others, speculating about a decision that hasn't yet been taken. I think the important thing to stress is that when it comes to levelling up, transport infrastructure is important. And transport infrastructure is not just about linking the great cities of the north with London. It's also about making sure that within those cities we improve transport links, and we also improve transport links between those cities as well.
Back in March, you said it will link through Crewe to Manchester. And you thought that was a good idea. Do you still think it's a good idea?
Well, I think the maximum amount of infrastructure investment, the better. But it's also important that we make sure that we get value for money. And the Chancellor, the Prime Minister and the Transport Secretary have been scrutinising a budget, which has been, I'm afraid, ballooning out of control. We need to make sure that we get value for money for every penny that the taxpayer gives us. Yeah. And so we're looking at all of our transport spending in order to make sure that we can get the most effective deployment of that infrastructure.
Boris Johnson, David Cameron, Theresa May, all close personal friends of yours, of course, they all say it should ahead. Mm. Are they wrong?
Well, I'm loath ever to disagree with Boris or with David or with Theresa, but they, while they all have distinguished records in government, don't have to grapple with the decisions that the Prime Minister and the Chancellor have to grapple with now.
This time last year, you joined us on the Times Radio stand in probably the greatest ever Conservative Party conference.
Yes, when I failed to make it to number 10.
You were a mere humble backbencher.
I was a backbencher, yes.
Yes, and now you're back in the cabinet. Back then, I asked you whether you agreed with your old friend Boris Johnson when he said benefits should rise in line with inflation. This is what you told me then.
My overall belief is Boris's argument was right. I would need a lot of persuading to move away from that, but I wouldn't want to prejudge an argument that was put in front of me before that argument was made, because in crises, you sometimes have to do things and embrace policies that would, in other circumstances, be deeply unattractive. But my basic position, my starting position is, yes, Boris was right.
So you said that you thought benefits last year should rise in line with inflation. Do you think this year that benefits should rise in line with inflation?
As I said last time, I think I'm not going to prejudge or anticipate the tough decisions that the Chancellor and the Welfare Secretary have to make.
Now, last year you said you agreed with Boris Johnson that it should rise in line with inflation.
But I also said before that I didn't want to prejudge. But I offered the a general opinion. But on this occasion, I'll be more reticent.
But have you changed your mind since last year?
I've changed my position.
But that just means you're in the cabinet. Are you making the case in the cabinet for increasing benefits in line with inflation?
Part of the privilege of being in the cabinet is that you get the chance to lobby for or to argue for certain positions. But coming with that freedom and with that ability to talk directly to ministers, there's also a responsibility to keep those conversations private. And that's what I fear I'm going to have to do.
OK, let's move on and talk about some of the actual announcements that have been happening in this conference. Your successor as Education Secretary is a job that you had for a long time, Gillian Keegan. Her big announcement yesterday was banning mobile phones in schools.
Good idea.
Well, I know it's a good idea. You talked about doing it in 2007, 16 years ago. You then announced it when you were Education Secretary. Gavin Williamson announced it twice when he was Education Secretary, in 2021 and 2023. Even Matt Hancock managed to announce it when he was Culture Secretary in 2018. Why is that the education set after 13 years in charge of the education system? Why is a re-announcement of a re-announcement of a re-announcement of a re-announcement of a re-announcement the big announcement from the education secretary?
It's not the only announcement from the education secretary. Throughout the year, you've seen Gillian delivering enhanced degree apprenticeship access. We've expanded the number of free schools in our country with a particular emphasis on new free schools for children with special educational needs. As I was reminding the conference, we also this year recorded the best results of any Western country in the international league tables for reading. This year, the schools that are getting the most students into Oxford and Cambridge, that's not the be-all and end-all, by the way, but it's still a good measure of success. Some of the schools that are getting the most students in are state schools. Brampton Manor, Harris Westminster, the London Academy of Excellence, that didn't exist 13 years ago. So, again, The policy that that Gillian announced is an important one, but it's only one of a range of things that we're doing in education. And our record in education, as Adam Bolton was being reminded on Sunday, is one of relentless improvement.
It's interesting, actually, because I was struck listening to you on the show with Adam Bolton at the weekend, where it feels like education is still the thing that really drives you, you're most passionate about. It's one of the few success stories that the Tories actually have. And that's why, you, as Levelling Up and Housing Secretary, you keep retreating back to education.
Not retreating. I'm very proud of what we've done in education. And it was not just me. It was the leadership shown by David Cameron and George Osborne. The continued leadership shown by Nick Gibb. And Gillian is taking it forward. But also in my speech...
she's taking forward the annual announcement about banning mobile phones in schools.
It's an important announcement. But the,
do you think you'll be announcing it again next year?
Well, text me or WhatsApp me and that. But the critical thing is also in my speech, which I had to keep to 10 minutes, I also referenced some of our other successes in government, our environmental successes, the fact that we're leading the world in the way in which we reformed farming support, the fact that we're the only country, I think, in the world to have reached the 30% of our oceans free of exploitation, the, you know, the 30 by 2030 pledge to rewild our seas. We're the only country that's met that. And, of course, we're leading on offshore wind. I also referenced some of the other changes that we've made, particularly because of the effective targeting of welfare. We've now got 1 million more people in work than when we came to power in 2010.
You mentioned the environment. That was a job that you did as well as Environment Secretary. Mm. Your successor as Environment Secretary this time used her big conversation. Therese Coffey's big announcement was that she said, bent or straight, the government should not be telling you how bendy your banana should be. So she's going to scrap the rules. Is that banana too straight? Is this the big issue that the government should be addressing, how bendy your bananas are?
My own view is that I should not be pronouncing on how straight someone should be.
Right. What about my banana?
Or something should be.
Right. Okay. We had James Cleverly as well, the Foreign Secretary, made a speech at a Fringe where he was claiming he was going to go to the Falklands because it wouldn't be safe if there was a Labour government. So we've got bendy bananas, loony lefties, saving the Falklands. This whole conference feels it's like a sort of 80s tribute act. There's no big new ideas here. It's re-announcements and it's bendy bananas.
Well, again, you were presenting at the time, but in the speech that I just gave, I outlined some of our plans on housing, some of the significant changes that we're going to make in order to regenerate town centres and to provide people with a route to home ownership. It was also the case that Steve announced as Health Secretary a significant expansion of medical school places, and it was also the case that Michelle, as Secretary of State for Science, Innovation and Technology, also announced additional support for the work that we're leading in artificial intelligence. So, of course, skilled journalism will involve picking up on a stray comment here or a fruit-based reference there, and that's fine. But in government, as I think Danny Finkelstein pointed out, you've got to care about everything.
Yes.
You've got to care about everything from
millions of people.
From the low-hanging fruit to the big bananas.
So but the thing is, millions of people care about getting on the housing ladder.
Yes.
You did have a plan for that.
I do.
And then, no, you did have, this is the problem. In 13 years of government, you have a plan and there isn't a plan. You have a target and there isn't a target. People just think, you've had 13 years to sort this out. Why do I believe Michael Gove now on housing when it's the opposite of what you've said before? It's the opposite of what you said before. Or it's just re-announcing again and again.
No, not at all. Not at all. So
you did. You had a national target and then you didn't because you gave in to your Tory MPs rather than people who can't buy a house.
We do have a national target and we've met it. We have two national targets, actually. 300,000 a year and 1 million...
Which we're not meeting.
No, we're not meeting that one, but we have met the target of 1 million new homes, or we're just about to, in this Parliament. And also, we're spending billions of pounds on our affordable homes programme, specifically in order to make sure that we can have more homes for social rent and more homes for shared ownership, as well as outlining plans, which I did in July, for significant investment in London to extend Docklands East, in Leeds in order to regenerate the city centre there, and also in Cambridge. To make sure that that city has a room
building,
to expand.
You had a target to build 300,000 homes with local targets imposed. There was a rebellion of Tory MPs and you tore that up. You put keeping Tory MPs happy before people who want to buy a house.
No, I wouldn't say that. What we did is we have kept those targets, but we've made sure that when local planning authorities come forward, if there are strong environmental reasons for them to say we need to protect the green belt or we need to protect an area of outstanding natural beauty, then the planning inspector will take that into account in assessing what the revised housing interesting target would be. Technical stuff.
Yeah.
But of course, people wanted to depict it in a particular way. That's fine. I understand how people create a narrative in politics. But
Michael, that is just what happened.
No.
You had a top-down target. There was a Tory rebellion, and you got rid of it.
No. That is the media narrative. That is not the truth. I'll tell you one thing, though, that is true about housing.
Well, I'll tell you what. Let's talk about truth. We don't have very long, Michael.
Nutrient neutrality.
Truth.
The truth there,
yeah.
We were bringing in plans which would have unlocked 100,000 new homes.
Yeah.
Labour voted against them. Keir Starmer allied with the Duke of Wellington in order to stop us building new homes for young people.
Let's talk about truth then. Why is the Energy Secretary making up that Labour want to tax meat?
I don't think Claire is making up anything.
But the Labour Party do not have a plan to tax meat.
Well,
she said in her speech in the conference, it's why Labour are so relaxed about taxing meat.
Well,
that's not true.
We know that Labour always in government.
No, that's not true, though, is it?
We know that Labour always in government.
It's not true.
End up taxing more. And taxing more widely than they said that they would. We also know...
You can't just make things up.
I know you can't.
You can't stand in a party conference speech and say Labour want to tax meat when that's not true.
Well, the truth is that Labour are the party of high taxation. They've been relentlessly the party of high taxation. And it is also the case...
No, I'll tell you what, there's one party which has been the party of relentless high taxation, and it's the government that you're serving in.
Well,
the highest level of taxes... You see, I don't know how you can go into an election talking about Labour are going to put up taxes when, as a Conservative government, we've got the highest level of tax ever.
Well, several things there. Firstly... It's Labour who've always levied a higher tax burden than the Conservatives. Secondly, the reason why we have taxes where they are now is because of, and I know that people are bored of hearing it, but it is true, and that's why it is repeated, because we have the consequences of the worst pandemic for 100 years and the biggest conflict on European soil since 1945. So these are inescapable pressures on our economy, but Conservatives... If you compare Conservatives, for example, in local government with Labour and Liberal Democrats, Conservatives always offer lower taxation.
Okay. I've known you for a long time. I think even before the 2010 election, our paths crossed a lot. You spent a long time trying to get the Conservatives back into a place of being electable. You thought big thoughts about education. You introduced them in the face of opposition. Some people liked them, some people didn't. I feel like you're somebody who wants big, you know, government to do big things.
Mm.
And... this feels like a very silly party conference, dominated by a row about a train line, which you said was a good idea, which now might not be a good idea, bananas, made-up meat taxes. Isn't it all just a bit... Didn't you just wonder what you're doing?
No. I was able, as I mentioned earlier, to run through not just 13 years of significant achievement, but also to lay out long-term plans for two of our biggest challenges. The Levelling Up White Paper... which my department published, was one of the most substantial analyses of how to overcome geographical inequality in this country. And the steps that we're taking, some of them distinctly unglamorous, but some of them very high profile, giving more power to regional mayors, investing research and development cash across the United Kingdom. That is big potatoes. That is an ambitious agenda.
Let's just focus on a bit. I'm slightly conscious of time.
Sure, sorry.
But the last, I know you have some experience of Tory leadership contests. At the last one, you didn't throw your hat in the ring.
No.
You said that Kemi Badenoch was the future of the party.
Yes.
Is that still the case?
Well, I think Kemi's great. Absolutely brilliant. Outstanding minister. The party took a view. We now have Rishi as our prime minister. In the choice between Liz and Rishi, with which party members were eventually presented, I said that I thought that Rishi was the better choice. A majority of my fellow party members respectfully disagreed with me at the time. But I think now that decision, I've got some things wrong in the past, as we know, that decision was at least vindicated.
I told you so, is what you're telling the party members.
I am not saying that. Others might say that. I'm just saying that I think we're all in a much better position with Rishi. No disrespect to Liz.
What about Suella Braverman? Kemi Badenoch's been very critical of Suella Braverman and her comments on the multiculturalism in the UK. And we've had a succession of Tory MPs and ministers saying that she's just completely out of line, what Suella Braverman was saying. What do you think?
No, Suella's a friend of mine, and I think she was making a very important point. I think that we as a country welcome tens, and indeed recently hundreds of thousands of people into our country, many of them fleeing persecution from Ukraine, Afghanistan, Hong Kong.
But she said multiculturalism had failed.
Well, the particular thing is, different people at different times either mean different things or infer different things. Mm. And the substance of Suella's speech was, if you're going to absorb, and we should, people from abroad who are fleeing persecution, you need a common culture, you need certain common liberal values, the rule of law, respect for free speech, and so on, which are non-negotiable.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is a critical point. And funnily enough, it is a point that's also been made by Angela Merkel, Emmanuel Macron, and a variety of other figures.
I don't know if you've seen the video. I know you're a man who likes dancing.
I do.
Have you seen the video of Priti Patel dancing with Nigel Farage?
No, I haven't.
I can't take my eyes off of you.
Mm.
What's the worst thing that you've ever seen, if you haven't seen that video already?
The worst thing I've ever seen is Keir Starmer trying to answer a question on Brexit.
Right, very good. You said that while fingering my banana. Now, would you like to have a go at my steady hand game? Victoria Atkins is top of the league table at the moment.
I think I'm going to fail.
Well,
because
it's very straightforward. You're a steady hand. You've been a steady hand on the government tiller for such a long time.
Where do I start?
You start on the left and move gradually to the right, like everyone does. Not yet. I'll tell you when you can go. Every time you buzz it, you'll hear that noise. We add 5 seconds. The quicker you get round it, the better.
Okay.
Wait, I haven't told you you can start yet. While you're doing it, you have to recite Rishi Sunak's 5 key pledges.
Okay.
On your marks, get set, go.
We are going to halve the rate of inflation.
That's one.
We are going to
stop. That's a buzz.
Stop the boats.
I think that's 2 buzzes.
We are going
that's another
grow
buzz.
Britain's economy.
Well, that's 3 pledges.
We're going to...
That's a lot of buzzes. That's a 5 buzzes.
Reduce the debt.
Yeah, that's good. That's 6 budget buzzes.
And we're going to
7
cut waiting
budges.
Lists in the NHS.
Right, very good. I'm going to say that 8 buzzes. Let's have a round of applause for Michael Gove. There we are. Slightly sarcastic sort of cricket round of applause. That, there. So what's the total time? 1 minute 12. Where does that put him? Bottom.
Second
for bottom. So there we are.
Second for bottom.
Yes.
So they're basically sort of the Burnley.
Levelling up Secretary Michael Gove there. Now, a little bit of our discussion on 100 years of Tory turmoil.
The threshold of 15% of the parliamentary party seeking a vote of confidence in the Prime Minister has been passed.
So the message today to Theresa May is that she has lost her moral and political authority. Her Brexit deal is dreadful.
We're leaving Downing Street for the last time. After 11 and a half wonderful years.
We will shortly be heading to Buckingham Palace to see Her Majesty the Queen, where I'll tender my resignation as Prime Minister.
I think it's a shambles and a disgrace. I think it is utterly appalling.
I can announce that the Parliamentary Party does have confidence. Yeah!
You have sat there too long for all the good you have done. In the name of God, go. Yeah!
Margaret Thatcher, John Major, William Hague, and now Ian Duncan Smith. This is starting to look like a habit inside the Conservative Party.
I've had enough of talentless people putting their tick in the right box.
Hasta la vista, baby. Thank you.
Wow. I mean, that's a lot of Tory turmoil, utter carnage there. Well, this year marks the formation. Since the formation of the 1922 Committee of Conservative MPs, who've then spent the last 100 years overseeing quite a lot of that turmoil, telling their leaders to come and go as they please. Known for a long time as the men in grey suits, they can end premierships and set the direction of the government. But is it them that hold the real power in Conservative politics? I'm joined by the party historian Philip Norton, Lord Norton, whose new book, 1922, Power Behind the Scenes, tells the story of this mysterious political force. Good morning, Philip. Good to see you.
Morning.
And we've also got Sir Graham Brady, who listeners will know, has been the chair of the 1922 committee since 2010. Good to see you, Graham.
Hello.
Nice to have you here. Philip, let's start, first of all, why are we marking the centenary of the 1922 committee in 1923?
In 2023, well, because it was founded in April 1923. Its name comes not from the year of its formation, but from the class of 22. It's formed by MPs first elected in the November 1922 general election. And as the months progressed, they, was one in particular, realised well, there's no induction for MPs. We've no idea what's going on. Let's get together. And so it's a sort of form. They formed what was, in effect, a self-help group to make sense of what's going on in Parliament. How can new members have an impact, take part in parliamentary life? So it really took off from there. It was a very limited existence. It later opened up membership to others, because otherwise it would have withered away in the fullness of time. And then 925 agreed to open up to all Conservative Prime members. Private members. This is significant because it's still private members. It was set up by the MPs, not by the party formally. So informal body, and it's private members, so it's not technically the parliamentary party, because it excludes the leader always.
Yes.
And ministers when in government. So it's really the voice of the backbenchers of the Conservative Party. Had a checkered history. It was fairly limited in scope and impact before the Second World War. It was formation of a national government that really helped make it, because it was the authentic voice of conservatism at a time when, you know, it's a national government, nobody could speak otherwise for it, because everybody was united publicly, but you had a forum behind the scenes where dissent could be absorbed. And it really took off from that. So what you're talking about in relation to the leadership, that's really from that period onwards. It influenced the party, influenced policy, but its main impact in terms of the party leadership is since it acquired the power to elect the leader in 1965, then in 1975, the power to re-elect, in other words, get rid of the leader.
Yeah.
So it's really taken off from there. It's the power that they've got to elect, and nowadays to remove a leader. Before then, you know, the men in grey suits going to tell a leader it's time to go. Yeah, it never happened.
Yeah,
that's a myth. They were more likely to be told to go by the equivalent of men in white coats. That's their doctors. So it's really developed over time.
And in the grand sweep of history, in 100 years of the 1920 Committee, has there ever been a chairman as famous as Sir Graham Brady?
No. well, it's quite interesting, because in the early years you had fairly long-serving party leaders, but some chairmen who would come and go, fairly short tenures, whereas the recent history is long-serving chairman Michael Spicer and then Graham Brady, who is the longest serving, when leaders have a more greater turnover than used to be the case. So it's an inverse relationship between what existed pre-war and what's existed in recent decades.
So Graham, what do you see as the role of the 1922 Committee, and is it different to everyone's perception of you popping up with increasing frequency in a wood-panelled room to tell us whether or not the government survives?
I think it is different, because understandably people often have the impression that our main focus is assassinating Conservative Prime Ministers, whereas actually our main focus is to try to make it work, and we try to make sure there is as good and open a channel of communication as possible between the leader and the backbenchers, between members of the government and the backbenchers. We try to make sure that leaders are well advised and well apprised of what the mood in the party is, what the colleagues will be prepared to wear and what they won't. And if prime ministers, leaders of the party, take account of that, in my view, they're more likely to last longer than if they don't.
Could you give us an example of a time where, as a result of your representations, you have managed to steer a prime minister into a new position?
Well, I mean, I think there are certainly times, and I think of the executive meeting with David Cameron at the in the run-up to the Scottish independence referendum, where we were making the case that the party needed to be doing a lot more than it was at that point. And you know, I think it might have helped to save the day at that point, because the party then engaged more, and we certainly put much more effort into campaigning at that point. So these things do crop up, whether it be me in private conversation with a leader, or the executive as a whole, or the officers meeting with the leader. We do have some very useful and constructive conversations.
Philip, across the whole century, as we're talking about it, was there a time when relations were especially good between Prime Minister or leader and the 22, or when was it particularly bad?
Well, it sort of varied, not just between leaders, but during a leadership, as you can imagine, because at certain times the party's riding high, leader's popular. I mean, Macmillan, when he first came in, gave the impression he was always popping into the 1922 committee, because he'd used that as a platform for the leadership, got it. But then, of course, towards the end, as the years progressed, ran into trouble.
Yeah.
and so the mood turned against him. So it's been quite varied. And again, with Margaret Thatcher, she started off very well, was keen to keep in, but then the longer in office, to some extent, you become more detached. She did. Occasionally, you've got leaders like Edward Heath who never really got on with the 22,
because or really anyone.
Well, I was going to say he was interested in policy, but not very good on personality, and didn't really mix. There was an attempt by the Chief Whip to organise a dinner between the executive of the 22 and the Prime Minister, and to bond, and it proved to be a total disaster. So it has varied, but a good leader is someone who needs to keep their own side.
Absolutely.
So you need to have that capacity, not just for the public performance in the chamber, but informally, mixing informally with members, but at the same time, keeping the party on board. Yeah. And so the 22 committee is absolutely crucial for that role in relation to leadership. But as Graham was indicating, the 22 goes far beyond that in the range of functions it fulfills. Some may seem quite mundane domestically to do with the party, things like that, but very important, and providing an outlet for backbenchers knowing they've got that outlet.
So go on then, of the many prime ministers that you've dealt with, Graham, who was the best to deal with and who was the worst?
Well, I suppose, as Philip says, sometimes it changes over time. And you know, I think probably my working relationship with Theresa May got rather more difficult as we got into the period leading up to the end of her time in office.
And it was that essentially because actually you were just bringing up bad news every day. More and more people were unhappy.
Yes, but
her deal wasn't going through.
But again, I also did try to oil the wheels and make the Brexit process happen more readily by proposing an amendment that was known at the time as the Brady Amendment, that was going to demonstrate that the British Parliament would vote for some kind of settlement and would prove wrong all the naysayers who said there's simply no settlement that the House of Commons will vote for. So, you know, I did try to help. And then maybe things got a little bit more difficult towards the end.
So Ellen Barfman's just walked past us, gave me a little wave. While she's just walking past, Graham, do you agree with her that multiculturalism's failed in the UK?
I think this is an important debate to have. I was reflecting to somebody the other day that, you know, I think you might possibly look over the channel at the performance of the French alternative approach and think that we've done rather better than they have.
I've heard from quite a lot of Tory MPs, actually, they're very unhappy about her speech. Is that the sort of thing they come to you about?
Absolutely everything.
Yeah.
And it's both people might talk to me directly, but also I think very important to stress, over the 26 years that I've been in the House of Commons, and for much of that time I've been on the 22 executive, either as chairman other capacity, the executive is normally genuinely representative of the whole spectrum of opinion in the parliamentary party, which can make it quite a difficult and lively group of people to chair at times, but it also means it's genuinely worth listening to. And certainly taking the executive to meet with a prime minister, I've had political secretaries say after the first meeting with the executive, you know, my God, this really is a representative body, isn't it? And I don't know what they expected, but
it's a broad range.
Absolutely.
Philip, explain to us about the process which the public will be most familiar with, the letters going in.
Yes. This.
How did that come about?
Well, this is what's created now as almost an invitation to struggle within the party, and that's part of the problem. Because I said in 1975 there was the power to re-elect, so members can get rid of a leader. Now in 1998 the rules were changed so that the parliamentary party, the 22's in control of the arrangements, the chairman is the returning officer for the election, but provided that the parliamentary party sort of selects two candidates put for the membership, so eliminating ballots to narrow it down to two.
Yeah.
But the final ballot, of course, you have three. So the top two go through, but the person who comes second in that ballot could have only, say, the third of the MP's vote. So Ian Duncan, the first time that was used, Ian Duncan Smith got the votes of about a third of the parliamentary party, which put him through to the final two. With Liz Truss last year, she got 32% of the votes in that final ballot.
Yeah.
So you've got somebody going for the membership, who the membership then elects as leader, but that person
doesn't command a majority of the MPs.
And, so that is a problem, which Andrew Leadsom recognised when she was the candidate against Theresa May. Now, she withdrew from the contest, ostensibly because an interview she gave to the Times mentioned, you know, Theresa May not having children. But before then, she'd already contemplated withdrawing because Theresa May got an absolute majority of MPs' votes in the final ballot. So there's always that tension there of a leader being leader by virtue of the votes of the party membership, but never demonstrating the full support of the parliamentary party. So it's never been a final ballot where most MPs have voted, therefore feel committed to that candidate. So that there's that instability written in since that change of the rules. Yeah. But then the parliamentary party has the power to remove the leader. Yep. I think that's the most important thing. Now, not so much the maker as the slayer of leaders, because 15% of the parliamentary, if they call for a vote of confidence, putting in letters to the chairman. So you end up with a chairman being better known than ministers, because journalists keep coming and asking
them
a question.
Because we want to know how many letters you've got at all times.
Asking them a question and never answer.
Graham, are they physical letters, or can people email them in?
It can be anything as long as it's verifiable, I think, as long as I know it's genuinely from the member concerned. I was going to say, though, that I do think it's important that the party members, when they vote in a final selection of two, should know the strength of feeling and the weight of opinion in the parliamentary party. Yeah. They can then make their own judgment about it. But my advice to successors into the future would be to hold a final indicative ballot so that the party members will at least know where parliamentary opinion lies on the issue.
So on the final two, before it goes to members or afterwards?
Absolutely, before it goes to members.
Yeah, that makes sense. Over the years, when you've read all the stories about so many 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 letters are integrated, are they ever true?
No. And as I said before, only I have known.
Yes.
And I think it's really important. It's a very difficult secret to keep. And I don't think it's fair to impose that on too many people. Yeah. So I've been the only person who's known. Of course, there are people sometimes who are very good at trying to work out who will or will not have submitted letters. And so this process can result in quite accurate estimates being made. But again, what they never know is whether people have subsequently withdrawn a letter.
Yeah.
Or indeed, as I've had on at least one occasion, I think probably more, where somebody has said publicly that they've submitted a letter and it was never submitted.
Yeah.
In fact, I had once a colleague who said publicly he'd submitted a letter when he hadn't submitted it, and then said publicly that he'd withdrawn it when it had never been submitted in the first place.
Was that Andrew Bridgen?
I couldn't possibly comment. but it does make it impossible, I think, for anybody outside to have an accurate sense of where things are. They might have an idea of a trend, and they will know that sometimes pressure is building, but they can't know.
Give us a sense then, finally, of the mood in the 1922 committee and backbench Tory MPs right now about the, it's the third successive party conference with a different Prime Minister. It's going, it's fair to say, better than last year, in that it's not all falling apart. But what's the mood amongst Tory MPs, particularly when lots of them, they look at the polls and they think, I'm going to be out of a job in 12 months.
I think the mood is probably not just better than last year, but better than you might expect. And I think part of the reason for that, we've obviously just reached the inflection point where Rishi Sunak, having spent 11 months demonstrating calm and stability, improving competence in government, has now started to announce new policies. And we've also seen the beginnings, it seems, of a move in the opinion polls. And we've seen some of the polls, one of them recently showing a reduction of the Labour lead from 20 points to 10. It's early days, but if we have more of the same, I think it's entirely possible to see how we claw back that position and see off Labour's opinion poll lead. It's been done before, as we know. It's entirely possible for governments or oppositions to go in, even into election campaigns with a substantial lead and then not see that.
That's Theresa May. Absolutely. We'll remember well.
Absolutely. So I think the mood is quite positive, and we feel as though we're at a point where things are starting to move.
And how many letters are in calling for a vote of no confidence in Rishi Sunak?
As you know, I never comment on that.
I thought I should ask. So Graham Brady, really good to see you. And Philip Norton, Lord Northern, author of the new book, 1922, Power Behind the Scenes, telling the history of the 1922 Committee. And that's all we've got time for on today's episode of the podcast. Don't forget to hit subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. But for now, for me, Matt Jolly, it's goodbye.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.